This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't the bottom, I just missed. My own sweet time, didn't teach what I found. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Mr. Shane Told. Yes, I am a mister. I don't know why I had to say that, but yes, Shane Told is here. That's me. This is my podcast. It's called Lead Singer Syndrome, and I speak to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a professional rock and roll band. Today we have a true rocker, Mr. Luke Bentham of the Dirty Nil, one of my favorite bands? Is that okay to say? Because it's absolutely true. Their last record, their debut record, Higher Power, was one of my favorite albums of 2016. I turned a lot of people on to this record. I turned a lot of people on to this band. And guess what? They won a Juno, which is basically like a Canadian Grammy, for Best New Artist, which is pretty crazy. We talk all about the shock of that and much, much more. This is a great conversation. Luke leaves absolutely nothing out. He explains it all. It's a good one. Sit back, relax, enjoy. But make sure you go check out the brand new The Dirty Nil record, which just came out on Friday. It's called Master Volume. Great title, a great album, full of bangers, and we talk all about the record. Definitely make sure you check it out. And of course, I will be playing some music at the end of the show, like always. If it's your first time joining me on my journey here, my podcast journey, I'm up to 140, I think like 6 episodes now, almost at the 3-year mark. It's crazy. I've been doing this for so long, but welcome. I always let everyone know. You can always get in touch with me. I read all my email. I try to respond to as much of it as I can. LeadSingerSyndrome@gmail.com is the email address. I'm also on all the different types of social media, so follow me on there. Hit me up on there if you want to. We're on Facebook. We have 3 delightful people that run the Facebook page for me because I don't know. I can't figure out Facebook. It's a clusterfuck, you know? There's a lot of shit going on. I don't really know what I'm doing. Maybe I'm just too old. I feel like old people use Facebook, though. That's like their one that they use. So, I don't know. I like Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I like those. Follow me on those. But definitely check out our Facebook because there is a lot of stuff on there as well. If you like the show, write a review on iTunes and make sure you hit that subscribe button as well. Last week was a great episode with, I was calling him a jokester, Mr. Zach Wild of Ozzy, of Black Label Society, of his own stuff. I was surprised a little bit happy-go-lucky, not serious he was, because, you know, you see that picture of him, and he's got that long Thor-looking hair and that big beard, and he's holding this metal guitar, and he looks all serious. Well, he was a very, very funny and enjoyable guy to talk to, and I think I get to see Ozzy, after all, this Wednesday in Detroit. I will be at the show. Very excited about that as well. So yes, go back, listen to that if you haven't already, and there's also like 144 other episodes to check out as well. In other news with me, what's new with me? Well, besides moving into a new house, that's exciting, right? Other than that, my band Silverstein, we are going on tour in Europe with Anti-Flag, some very good friends of ours. It's going to be an awesome co-headline tour, lots of Germany and other places in the mainland. Get tickets for that. They're available now. And after that, we're doing a U.S. and Canadian tour. Well, sort of Canadian. We're playing Toronto, Montreal, and London. So I know Canadians get a little bent out of shape when I say it's a Canadian tour and it's like 3 shows. But we are coming to Canada as well as the U.S. on a headliner celebrating 15 years of our first album, When Broken Is Easily Fixed. We will be playing the whole thing and more. Tickets are really selling. They're going fast, but they're still available. And to check them out and check out VIP and all that good stuff, it is When Broken, the link is, I should say, whenbrokenisEasilyFixed.com. I want to give a big shout out to all my sinners worldwide. You know who you are. These are the members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. That's right. We got a club. We got a club, baby. It is a great community. We hang out all over the world. All these things happen. Sinner meetups all over the place. It's awesome. You got to check it out if you want to meet like-minded people that are a fan of this show, that are a fan of great music. It really is very, very, very cool. And of course, you get access to bonus episodes, more interaction with me, merch and patches sent to your house every 3 months. It is really just a good time. And of course, it is the reason this show continues. It is what keeps this thing possible to be going and growing week after week with great guests like Luke Bentham, like Zach Wild, like Jonathan Davis, like Anthony Green, like Caleb Shomo, like Spencer Chamberlain, like Fat Mike, like Joey Cape, like so many guests, I'm forgetting them. 140-something guests, all brought to you in part by the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. So yes, check it out for as little as $6 a month. That's what gets you in. And it really does go a long way. The link, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. That's right. leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Check it out. Let's be friends. Let's hang out. Sinnerfest 2.0's got to be happening somewhere. California maybe this year. I don't know. We're figuring it out. Check out the link, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. All right, that's enough. Let's get into this very great conversation with one of Canada's finest rock and roll bands, Canada's finest punk bands. I don't know what they are. They're a great band. You need to know them. So check this out. Here it is, my conversation with Luke of the Dirty Nil. Yo.
Yo, how's it going, Shane?
Great, man. How are you? It's been a long time.
I'm very well. I'm in Hamilton. A crazy, crazy thunderstorm has just begun.
Oh, seriously? Wow. I'm in Windsor, and it is like a sunny, sunny fucking day here, so I don't know.
It was like a Florida-type humidity situation happening, total blue skies, and now it's like post-apocalypse. Crazy.
It happens, man. Yeah, just the other day, I'm out here in Windsor these days. Lucky me. And yeah, it was like I went into a Shopper's Drug Mart, and it was like fine, like, you know, sunny, and was just shopping around. You know, they got some good deals, Shopper's Drug Mart.
Got some good deals, man. They got a monopoly.
You get the sales? No, they got the sales, man. Like, you go and you get stuff on sale. I got that I don't know if you say Knorr or Knorr. They make the soup I really like. 99 cents.
Oh yeah,
99 cents.
Oh yeah, so 99. Can't beat it.
So I'm in the soup aisle, and I'm hearing like I heard this crash, and I'm like, "What the? That sounds like thunder, but can't be thunder." It was thunder. I went outside. It was like dark out. It was crazy.
It's that kind of period right now in the weather where it's like when things get so hot, the entire weather system. I mean. Being not a meteorologist, I'm speaking from the heart, but not from knowledge. I feel like it just gets so goddamn hot that the whole thing's just like, all right, we just got to reset this motherfucker. That's kind of what the Earth is doing. But anyways, amateur weather theories from Luke.
That sounds pretty good. And wouldn't you know, holy shit, I just looked outside and it is raining. There's water on the window. So
it just
got over here to Windsor. Anyways, hey, yeah. Let's meteorology aside, I'm here with Luke of the Dirty Nil. an old buddy of mine. Dude, I haven't seen you in a while, and so much has happened since we last spoke. New record coming out in very soon, like a week.
Very soon. September 14th.
September
yes.
14th. Master Volume, great title.
Thank you.
Let's start there, man. Tell me about this journey over the last couple of years since I've seen you, and how it's been with leading up to this record.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess when we were last hanging out, at least in a kind of consistent sense, was the Warped Tour of 2015.
Wow.
And we were kind of, yeah. And so we were basically just kind of getting, we were in the middle of making Higher Power, then kind of getting mixes and stuff. And it was going to come out in the beginning of 2016. So we hadn't even put out a full length record yet. So basically, since the record came out in February or January 2016, we've just basically been doing, I mean, we did a little bit of headline touring across Canada and the States and England and Germany, but we've done about 2 years, I would say, or a year and a half of support tours, which has brought us all over, and we've met a lot of people. But we've been able to do some really big ones in Canada and Europe, with Billy Talent,
yeah,
and America, or Against Me brought us all around the United States and Canada, which was amazing last fall. We had a lineup change in the fall of about 2 years ago now, coming up on 2 years ago.
Wow, it's crazy. It's been that long. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, I mean, we hadn't really, when Dave had been in the band for over 5 years, and we had played a lot together and done a lot of touring. But I mean, I think you kind of get to a point, a lot of bands, at least when I talk to you, in your mid to late 20s, where people kind of, it's kind of the time where a lot of people's life circumstances become more demanding, or they kind of decide what they want to do more. So, I mean, the pressure kind of only increases, right? To bring home the bacon the older you get. So
that's right.
And whether you actually, I guess, ultimately enjoy touring, right? Whether you are, because everybody gets the blues sometimes on tours, but it's whether you enjoy and feel fulfilled with that lifestyle. And he wanted to kind of look for other things in life, which I totally understand and respect. So we had a very very kind of respectful see you later kind of handshake, and then Mr. Ross Miller, our mutual friend who we had kind of played shows with since we were about 20, he joined the band. So he was actually living in a house with us, with Kyle and I, at the time.
Wow, that's perfect.
And we were auditioning bass players. We had some guys from the States come up, and guys who we had kind of seen all along the way who were like, dig his style, he's cool. But you know how it is, like when you're searching for somebody to be creative with, it's not really how it looks on paper. It's like you don't know until you get in a room and see if you can work together, whether your chemistry works.
Yeah.
So Ross was the first, and I mean, we had, as I said, done a few auditions, but we did one practice with Ross, and this kind of song that had been kind of tormenting us, the arrangement hadn't been coming together. We did one jam with Ross, and he had some great suggestions, and it came all together, and that was basically it. So Ross joined at the beginning of 2017. And then we basically, from that moment forward, just wrote and practiced every single day until for 1 year. So we did a year basically of constant touring all together as the beginning of that lineup, and writing and rehearsing every single day. Basically, we took a few weeks off in August, but the record was written on the road, and it was the fastest that I've ever written in terms of like. It was definitely, it was a bit of a do or die time, because it had been a while since we had put out Higher Power. But I mean, we hadn't had any new songs that had joined the set since the beginning of 2015. So we needed an influx of new material and new energy. So
definitely.
I mean, last year was definitely the hardest that we have ever worked.
bar none. I would say we worked harder last year than the previous 3 years combined. It was constant practicing and demoing with something we never did really before, and just really, really working hard with a focus of making a really kick-ass album.
Awesome.
And learning learning some lessons in the studio, making Higher Power about when to listen to a producer and yada yada yada, when not to be an asshole. So, anyways,
we
formed all of last year around gearing up to make this album, and then we made it at the beginning of this year with Mr. John Goodmanson from Seattle, who's a very accomplished producer and mixing engineer,
amongst
other things, but also a fantastic human being. I mean, he's worked with like Blood Brothers and Ceremony and Death Cab for Cutie and Sleater-Kinney, and he lives next door to the Pearl Jam guys. So he had like great stories for days. I mean,
all we
wanted to know was all of his new metal stories, though. We really wanted to hear about working with Saliva and Korn and stuff. Those were the ones we wanted to hear. But we did it in 3 weeks. We're very, very ready to make the record. I mean, there's a few nice things that kind of came together in the studio. We were too tight, or at least too over rehearsed or anything like that. But we had really very prepared and very, very confident, ready to make the record.
That's good, man. Wow. So much there to ask you about. And I don't even know where to start, but I guess we'll start with the departure of Dave, and we'll get that out of the way, because, you know, the Dirty Nil obviously is a three-piece band, and I feel like in a three-piece band, there's always a little bit more weight carried per member. You know,
of
I'm
course.
In a five-piece band, and, you know, it's like a couple people can be working on something, and then, you know, the other guys can kind of be shooting the shit over here, and not everybody has to be involved in every, like, little decision. But,
no.
But with I guess when you have a three-piece band, it's like there's always one guy that's kind of like the going to side with one side or the other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the swing vote, you know?
So, yeah, exactly.
So with Dave, you know, being out of the band and to Ross, you know, not only is that a big change just personally and decision wise and stuff, but Dave was also, you know, a fairly important member of the band in that he did do some lead vocals. There were some Nardi songs that, you know, would kind of come out, and it was a different sort of tone for you guys. Mm-hmm. It would be like a different switch live. You'd kind of get a little bit of a break. So how's that adjusting? Because I believe the new album is all you, right?
It is. Now, I mean, I really enjoyed like just getting to play guitar. Like that's something that I really enjoyed getting to do, just like getting to focus on, because I love playing guitar the most. So I really enjoyed those. And Dave is also one of the coolest writers. Like he has some I always loved his more kind of vulnerable side as a writer. So I really enjoyed playing those songs. But I mean, when we kind of, one of the things that was a point of pressure on the band that was increasing, that was just one of the reasons, obviously, that go into a lineup change. But one of them was that as we began to start playing in front of bigger audiences and bigger crowds, reconciling the differences in our two sound started to become a bit of an issue and a bit of a point of contention about what kind of band we wanted to be, you know, because some people who knew Fugazi and knew Minor Threat or whatever, knew like some of the touchstones that we were going for and like liked hardcore but also liked Weezer, could get behind and really saw that as kind of a special feature of the band that we could have that kind of flexibility. But I would say that a lot of people didn't see that. A lot of people, I would say, when we would tour, the last few months of touring, we received a lot of, like, I mean, people just give you their feedback, whether you wanted to hear or not. And there was a lot of people that, you know, just told us their honest opinion. And we could tell that some people were kind of being confused by that kind of split-headed presentation.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was just one of the things also going into the ultimate, like, parting of the ways. But I mean, that led to us like really having to, I mean, at some point in a band's trajectory, they got to sit down and figure some things out. They got to figure out, what are we going to do? Like, you can't just sit there and we're going to be a band and we're just going to go up there and we're going to play our songs and it's going to be nothing. You got to figure out how you want to present yourselves, because that's part of the art, right? How you want to, how you want to structure your set, how you want to do your merch. All of these things are decisions and extensions of your creativity. So right. You kind of have to just like sit down and figure those things out. And what are your goals, right? And how are you going to work towards those goals? I think that when we were in our early 20s and like 19 and stuff, like our goal was to just basically play shows. We didn't really have anybody that we were looking up to,
yep,
or any kind of like tangible steps on how to achieve things. Like, we're just like, we want to do a club tour and for people to show up. Like, I don't know. Like, we didn't have fucking goals because we were just from Dundas.
Well, you didn't know yet, though. I mean, you haven't.
We didn't know, right?
There's a lot of trial and error that goes into being a band.
A lot of trial and error, and a lot of like, you don't know what you want until you kind of start seeing other people and what they have, and you're like, okay, well, that's a cool thing. That would be cool if one day we had a version of that for ourselves.
Right.
So one of the things was like, I mean, we had done some. You came out and saw us, actually. We did that flag tour.
Yeah.
So we opened for Black Flag, yes. Or they're not allowed to call themselves that because Greg Ginn is contractually owns the name, but for all intents and purposes, yes, we got to play with Black Flag. Just obviously a wonderful notch on the old belt for anybody who grew up on that kind of music like us. So
right.
That was fantastic, and that kind of split side thing where Dave could I could give them
it worked in that environment.
So I could give them some sugar and then Dave could drop the hammer, like that worked there. But then when we were playing with like Billy Talent, or
I saw you guys there too, actually.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, I don't mean this in any kind of disparaging way, but any like people who are less musically literate or less musically pretentious, not even pretentious, but like less, you know, people who are more your average music fan who don't go to that many shows and they just come to a big show a few times a year and they come to see the thing, that aspect of the band was kind of confusing people. And it wasn't like we want to play to the gallery and like we want to just like, okay, well, what's going to make people happy? Let's just do that. That's not our mentality. But as I said, it's all just little pieces of pressure that kind of put themselves on your organization.
No, it's hard to think of a band that has that. You know, that's achieved, you know, a lot of success. The one that comes to mind is maybe the Goo Goo Dolls. Their bass player sings a bunch of the songs. Like, if you've ever heard any of their records, it's like kind of weird. And the other one that I remember is Propagandhi. You know,
yes,
when John Sansom used to be in the band from the Weaker Thens, and they had, so, you know, Less Talk More Rock by Propagandhi is like 28, it's a 14 song, like 25-minute record, and it's bangers. And then there's pretty much two Weaker Than songs on the record, which are like really out of left field, to where you're like, okay. And it's
interesting.
Like, you had to know that guy wasn't going to stick around. Like that was his passion, that he wanted to do that. So I kind of understand it, you know. And for you guys, it's the opposite. You know, you were, like you said, sugar versus hammer. Which I love. But so I totally understand that the change. But you know, I think it's always obviously a big deal when a three-piece band changes a member, more so than a bass player maybe in a five-piece band. Maybe that's not accurate, but I feel like
I think you know, I can only speak from my experience, and I would just say that if I in my fantasy scenario, I would feel a lot more comfortable in like a Guns N' Roses type deal if I had to switch out like one of the five guys rather than like, if you have to switch a three piece is tricky, right? To make everything work. And like, as you said, like if the less members, the more responsibility per member, right? Mm-hmm. Even like down to like the mechanics of the sound. Like if somebody's instrument cuts out, it's that much more noticeable if there's not a rhythm guitar or whatever.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Absolutely.
So there's just more weight per member, and obviously in a creative sense too, like it makes the chemistry that much more touchy because every single person is obviously important to the way things get arranged and the way you sit down and do the nuts and bolts and get together and communicate with one another, you know, like to be able to get along and communicate effectively and to make decisions together and to agree on a direction and to feel comfortable with that direction. And, you know, all of the interworking politics are far more delicate and like unknowable until the rubber actually meets the road, right? Like you just don't know the way these things are going to go until they unfold. So that was that was a stressful point of like obviously having that vacuum of like, okay, well, I mean, we need to find somebody who we can get along with and who we can get all this stuff done with. And so that became clear about how complicated that task was when we started auditioning people, practicing with people. And we found that it's like, yeah, they can play the bass lines fine. Like, they're not necessarily that complicated at all. But, like, it's can they, you know, contribute creatively, which is a very important feature, obviously, when you're there's only three people in your band and you got to arrange things together, but also can they hold their own their side of the stage and be able to not just be a wallflower if there's only three of you, right? Like you can't just have
it makes so much sense.
You know, a guy who's just playing it lick on their side when there's only three of you, and when you're playing in a, you know, bombastic rock and roll band. So I mean, when Ross joined, and I mean, a lot of these things, a lot of the elements of this kind of chemistry and these, like, we kind of grew into and adjusted around each other and adapted to our new group of people. But the one thing that we knew is that, like, right off the bat, is like we were hanging out every day all together, practicing every day, and we were very aware of the fact that, you know, It is do or die for us right now. We've got to hit the ground running, and basically, in terms of having a, you know, your own little small business, it's us versus the world. Basically, we're the best friends we each other have. We need to basically just support each other as hard as we can, and just like work with each other, and because if all futures depend on our ability to work together, and I mean, we saw it in those kind of black and white terms, and I'm very happy to say that we have risen to the occasion and delivered fantastic rock and roll album.
Here
September
it is.
14th.
September 14th. Available. There's another plug.
Fine records are sold.
There you go. Where are they even sold anywhere?
Full of them.
I was somebody when our last record came out. And sorry about the audio, right? The audio was getting a little wonky for you. I don't know if you're in a weird place, but my apologies. We could hear what you're saying. It was just a little gerbled.
All good.
Jumbled. It's funny because in Canada now, you know, our record came out last year and somebody was like, hey, like, I'm in Vancouver. Where can I pick up your album? And I'm like, I have no fucking idea. Where do you go to buy a record anymore?
Idea. Yeah.
And I guess Sunrise Records is, that's the one now. That's their, they took over HMV and that's the place. That's it. I mean.
That's the one. Yeah.
There's one.
Physical
there's
copies,
one now.
Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's indie shops and stuff. I don't want to pretend what that is. And that's obviously important.
Of course.
Many great record stores in Toronto, Hamilton, everywhere. But chain record stores in small town, it's few and far between.
That's a tough one. But best of luck to you. Best of luck to you.
Best of luck to you. It will be available on streaming services as well. Hey, man, I want to go back a little bit, and I want to talk about your early life. And I think it's interesting because we grew up, you know, I'm a bit older than you, but we grew up in similar areas. I'm from Oakville, Ontario. You're from Dundas, Ontario, which is maybe a 30 to 40 minute drive, I'd say.
Yes.
Like that. So, I'm really curious about what it was like for you growing up, what your family structure was like, and kind of how music was, you know, in your the early days.
Sure. Well, my parents were extremely, I got my first guitar when I was 12. I guess I should say that. I got my first guitar when I was 12. Shortly before that.
What kind of guitar was it?
It was a Squire Stratocaster.
Perfect.
Strat Pack with the amp and the strap and the whammy
comes
bar.
Comes in a box.
The whole comes in a box.
You
exactly.
know it's good.
You usually get sold at a garage sale in a box too. But mine has not been. But I remember one of the first most kind of important musical moments that I ever had was being I was 12 years old, and September or so of 2002, and Nirvana was just releasing their box set, like their not the box set, rather their greatest hits. And I was watching Much on Demand for those who it was in the morning before school for those who remember Much Music, and all these people kept voting for the video for "You Know You're Right" by Nirvana, and I had never heard Nirvana before, and the video for "You Know You're Right," if you're not familiar with it, it's a montage of like live Nirvana footage, and it's kind of like a really really like souped up sounding demo of that song, but it's so raw and so crazy. I remember hearing that, like, I had never heard anything like that on TV, and TV was really my only access to music other than like listening to what my parents' friends were listening to, because I mean, or whatever. So I remember that song came on the TV and my parents were eating breakfast and they kind of recoiled in like disgust at the sound of Kurt Cobain's voice and like the kind of feedback in the song, like, what the fuck is that? And like, I just noticed this like physical, like, as I said, discomfort that they were experiencing from a song. And I'm like, cool. I'd never seen adults affected by a song before.
Love it.
So, yeah. So then that was obviously, dope. That was great. And I was like, and then I really got into Nirvana really hard after that and got that CD, from HMV. And then my godfather had heard that I wanted to play bass, and I saw bass as my entry point into getting a guitar one day. And then he basically, for my birthday, he got me one of those $300 Strat packs and said, fuck bass, you're going to play guitar. And he gave me a guitar, and I played Mission Impossible with my thumb for a year. And then
what does that even mean?
Exactly. I kind of just picked out simple melodies with my ear and then like try to play with my thumb. And then my first guitar teacher, who is still my guitar teacher to this day, he's been my guitar teacher now for, let me think here, 16 years now.
Cool. That's cool.
Mr. Mike Treblecock, which is a fantastic name for a guitar player.
Treblecock,
yeah. So he was the singer, guitar player, songwriter of the Killjoys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I love the Killjoys. Today I hate everyone.
Exactly. Whoa. So he taught me how to play guitar starting at age 12 and up till now. So, and beyond. But so that was kind of really how I got into things. My parents were super supportive of the thing because, I mean, before then I was like sitting in my bedroom building like model airplanes, just like shut off from the world. They're like, I'm glad to see he's out doing something. So they were pumped to drive me to guitar lessons. And I'd say in terms of like the music that I grew up on as a kid, my mom listened to shit music, though she saw a lot of great shows that she kind of eventually came around to like liking again. But like, she from the get-go was like Women in Songs and Enya and shit, and I was like, this is awful. And then my dad listened to like harsh as fuck country music that I loved, like John Prine, Sweet Revenge was an album always around, and Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen. Stompin' Tom Connors, Canadian legend.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash Live at Folsom was always on. So that kind of stuff was really, really. And then like the Guess Who, a lot of CanCon.
Yeah.
But mostly like real like country songs about murder. That was I grew up on a lot of that. And then my mom once I started really getting into music, She kind of went back and reverted to the music that she listened to when she was a kid, and like she saw Bowie back in the 70s and Zeppelin when she was a teenager and stuff. So she got back into that stuff, and then I mean she's always asking me for new bands and stuff. So I still show her like all the bands that we play with, and so I'm really fortunate to get to still enjoy like music with my mom.
Well, it sounds like your parents are very open minded and supportive, which is great. Do you have any brothers and sisters?
Very much so. I got two younger sisters. Yeah.
Cool.
And neither of them. I mean,
do they shred as hard as you?
They they were forced at bayonet point to try and play piano, but after years of tears, the piano was sold and they were freed from their shackles and allowed to do whatever they wanted to do. I was the only one that voluntarily wanted to play music.
That's very funny. So we got Nirvana, and you know, one of the things that I love so much about your band is just it's got a lot of. There's a lot of things going on, and it's hard to when Higher Power came out, it's a record that I really championed, and a lot of the guys in my band, like, you know, like Paul Mark and stuff, we would go over and watch you guys play on the Ernie Ball stage on Warped Tour, and you know, we really like really loved your band, and the amount of people that I was like, you gotta check out this record, and then people would ask me what it sounds like, and I'd be like, well, it's like and I never knew what to say. I'm like, it's loud, it's like kind of punk rock, but then it's like sort of got like a classic rock kind of element. And then I'm like, I have to mention the aesthetic of your band, which is like, it's a Les Paul plugged in a Marshall, and he's got like the Jimi Hendrix style, you know, coiled, like curly coiled patch cord. And, you know, he's like chewing gum and he's smiling at the girls in the crowd, and he's got stars on his shirt, and like, this is all important part of your band is your aesthetic, and you're like not afraid to say fuck you and you know, and use whatever language you need to express what you're expressing. So all of these factors come in, and I'm just saying, okay, Nirvana, but then what else latched on to make this band that is so unique?
Well, thank you. That is a high compliment to be able to evade simple description. I think that
absolutely, man, totally.
I think that one of the primary influences on our band, at least, kind of what starting around when we were about 20 or 21. By the way, we're 28 now. So, like, when we were like, this is kind of around when we did Fucking Up Young and kind of like around in that area and started to advance further is. We really got into, or at least I did, the MC5 and that kind of like really bombastic, like it's kind of like At the Drive-In, but like more proto version of that, I don't know how to describe it. Like it was central to my ideas and like about aesthetic was a very loud imagery and not afraid to present something bold, because it's more, it just made it more fun for me to like kind of put like this. I mean, the Starshirt thing was a strange thing that just kind of started by like most things, just like by accident. We were on tour in Montreal on one of our first tours ever in 2011. And, we were in one of those stores where everything is $10. And one of my friends pulled that off the rack. And it was, you know, $10, the first Star shirt. It's the one that I wear in the Fucking Up Young video. I still have it, but it was $10. It's like, if this is the dumbest shirt I've ever seen, if you wear this, I will buy it for you. I'm like, fuck yeah. So I wore it and I didn't take it off for 2 weeks. And we were like sleeping in the van and like, this. I didn't take it off and people started commenting nonstop on this shirt. And I was just like, I almost got in a fight about it. Like this guy was like trying to like, he was like, fucking god, we're in a fucking shower curtain, like I don't know, like this guy on some sort of weird crusade. But anyways, then it just kind of started and I realized that like this is kind of a thing a little bit, and it kind of was sitting in the back of my mind, and then I'm like, okay, I really need a second one, and I couldn't find the brand. And then my more hip clothing buddies were like, yo, check this one out, like would send it to me over Facebook, like this like Levi's one. So then that was the one that I wore for like 3 years. I bought three of them when they came out, and then like I just kind of linked onto them, and then I ran out of kind of off the rack ones, and then I basically found this lady named Wendy who lives in Guelph, who's got a company called Canary Naturals, and she had, I got her number through the guys from the Sadies because she had made their suits and some stuff for Gord Downie and some stuff for Joel Plaskett and a bunch of guys. Like all the – anytime you see some really crazy embroidered shirts in the Canadian music industry, she's probably made it because it's such a specific skill set. But anyways, we got in contact and it was a a perfect kind of meeting of people, because I was desperate for another shirt, and she obviously has a unique skill set that not many people have. So we've had a great relationship since then. She's made me 3 or 4 shirts, and it's super fun kind of getting together and being like, okay, what if we did this? So we kind of just sit there and kind of collaborate on some stupid, insane shirt that, like, most people, when I tell them, I'm like, this is what I'm going to make as a shirt, they're like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then they see the shirt and they're like, all right, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Like, I wouldn't wear it, but good for you. So I enjoy kind of getting to have some sort of, like, almost comic book, like, superhero, like, element of... that I just kind of, I saw, as I said, in the Bowie stuff and the, yeah, and the MC5 stuff from Detroit in the late 60s, that kind of, I mean, cause we just, you know, we toured so much with, I think that visual presentation is one of the most important and, best tools to utilize as a performer. Obviously it's like, it's your primary thing that you're kind of getting across other than the sound. So I think that when people do interesting combinations of things, it makes it more engaging. But it was definitely a very natural evolution, but we stole a lot of moves from the MC5. It just kind of looks a lot more domineering and aggressive when you've got giant oversized cabinets and curly cords going right back to them.
There you go. Curly cords.
And we used curly cords since we were teenagers, so we just always enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's something that nobody does anymore. Like, I don't think I've seen any other band do it, so that's cool. It's a thing. You have a thing.
You got a thing. You got to do the thing.
So another kind of interesting thing about your band was, at a very young age, you were, well, not signed to, but you put out a record on Fat Records, which is, yes, you know, Fat Mike of NOFX's label, and a kind of, like, now at this point, a sort of a boutique kind of punk label, has a niche fan base, and something that I was, you know, really into all those bands, you know, like over 20 years ago, I guess now. Well, still am, but was then too. And how did that all actually kind of start? Because it's an interesting story of just some kids from Dundas, Ontario end up signing or putting out a record on this label at a young age.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
It's a testament to the idea that, like, you never know what efforts and what labors are going to bear what fruit, if any, you know, like, it was mm-hmm. just, you never know what seeds are going to, that you're planting, kind of how they're going to turn out. So we played this one show in December of 2013, where I had such bad food poisoning that I could, like, barely stand. I was vomiting so much, but we had to play this show. It was Burley Calling. Played this show. I immediately, like, afterwards got whisked back to my house and, like, stayed in bed for, like, days, because I was just so sick. They kicked me out of the venue because I puked in the bathroom. They thought I was drunk.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was so sick. Anyways, at that, I didn't want to play that show, but we played the show. And at that show was a good guy named Patty Skinner, who bought a stack of our 7-inches, the Fucking Up Young Ones, and then was immediately flying, because he's friends with Fat Mike, to Fat Mike's house. And apparently, according to Mike, Patty had never shown a band to him and been like, yo, check out this band. And we were the first one he'd ever done. So he took our 7-inch, put it on his table, and listened to Fucking Up Young. And he said he listened to it a gajillion times over and over and over again. And then started tweeting how to find my phone number. And he got my phone number and he called me while I was like,
wow.
He called me while I was drunk at a bar. And I need to say something that I never grew up on NOFX. It was just not part of our universe. We were really into, like, Pinkerton, Weezer kind of stuff, but in that, the NOFX thing never really permeated into Dundas. So I just wasn't aware of the music, but I was very much so aware of Mike. I knew about Mike because my window into music was more or less just Much Music on TV. So I remember, like, the punk show and him coming on and doing interviews, and, you know, he's a guy, he's like Lemmy or something. He's a person that, he's bigger than his music. in terms of a personality.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
I mean, it was like you don't have to know any of his songs, but you'll still know who he is. So that's kind of how I remember specifically when I was a kid that he had got into a bunch of like controversy on a previous Warped tour for having beef with Under Oath. I distinctly remember that.
I was on that tour.
Music. Were you?
Yeah.
Were you?
I was there, and it was weird for me because I was like, NOFX is one of my favorite bands ever. I watched them on stage every day. I knew Mike. We played poker every night. I wrote their set list sometimes, and but I'm really close friends with Under Oath too. So I would like, I'd be on stage for NOFX, like them making fun of Under Oath, and then I'd go over and watch Under Oath, and I was like, this is weird. I'm friends with everybody, but I feel like I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, and you just kind of got to slink into the corner and just let it play out. It was strange,
and then Under Oath left the tour, and it was a whole thing. But so anyways, Fat Mike calls you at a bar when you're drunk.
Calls me at a bar when after I've had a couple, and he's like, this is Fat Mike. I'm like, fuck off, and I like hung up. And he called me back, and then we talked, and he's just like, yeah, I love your band, like, yada, yada, yada. And I was like, that's really cool, and we had a conversation. He's like, and he wanted to put something out. And so we were like, hell yeah. And we, at the time, we were just kind of getting into wanting to do our first tour of the States, so it was kind of a really nice springboard for us. It was an added, like, promotional feature, of like an entry point into touring there. It gave us an excuse, I guess you could say, having an American label release a few of our songs. So that was a great connection. And then since then, I mean, we've kind of met up in a bunch of different places in funny ways. I love Mike. We've hung out a lot since then. Like, we helped him set up his sex dungeon in LA once.
Great.
He's like, hey, are you guys busy for the next hour? Can you help us? So we're like, sure. So we did that. And then, I mean, at Riot Fest in Chicago when we played a couple years ago, he was there, so we hung out then. And then we hung out when we played together in Austin, Texas at South By one year. And he came out and saw us in San Francisco a few months ago. We were playing with Against Me. He just, like, I didn't know he was there. He fucking jumped on the stage while we were playing Fucking Up Young and grabbed the mic from me, which was always a hilarious thing.
Yeah.
And I love that guy. He's a very colorful human being, and nice. I love any opportunity that I get to see him, even if we're just kind of passing ships in the night, you know?
Sure. No, I love that guy too. So, yeah, it's interesting, though. You start out with a 7-inch record. You're with a song that has an F word in it.
Yeah.
Put out on a punk label.
Mm-hmm.
And then just a few short years later, you're winning a Juno, which is, for the American listeners, which is a Canadian Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
You're winning a Juno for best new, whatever it is, best new artist, best new band. Breakthrough artist, I think it's the term they use now. That had to be unexpected.
That was not expected at all, especially...
even to be nominated probably was unexpected.
The nomination was in and of itself the greatest surprise.
Yes.
Because, I mean, we just... When you grow up in Canada, you know of the... You, no matter what you know of the Junos, it's just part of the cultural landscape here. Like, your parents probably talk about it. It's in the newspaper whenever it happens. It's a big deal in Canada. It's our music weekend. I remember watching it as a kid with my family, like when it happened on that Sunday or whatever. So when we were recognized by that institution, it was like, it was a real, you know, it was, even if we were like, we felt like we didn't really even belong in that kind of category, or felt like, hey, this is hilarious, like being breakthrough new artist and we've been a band for 10 years. This is hilarious. But, it was, we were like, hell yeah, like, this is great. Like, my mom's pumped about it. So fuck yeah. Like, I mean, everybody get, that was a massive step for us. And it's, as I said, it's, you never know what little seeds are going to bear fruit and how they're going to do it. And how it's the best. Like, last year we had some of the craziest, coolest surprises happen just because of, that just came completely out of left field. Like, the Juno and the getting to play with the Who, like all these things that you just never plan on, that would have never imagined would happen to you, and they just kind of happened. But I mean, the Juno thing was, I had, when I looked at our category and the other things, people that we were up against, I just didn't think that there was any way that we were gonna, I mean, that in terms of when they put it this way, when they played our music, when they played all the band's music before they read the winner and they were kind of announcing the category and all the nominees, there was just like, there was these very, very kind of slick sounding recordings with, you know, really glossy production. And then when they got to us, it was this kind of like crash of feedback, and everybody in the banquet hall kind of like winced up their shoulders for a second. And like,
it was like when your parents heard, was it like when your parents heard Nirvana for,
it was
when you were 12
exactly
years old?
Like that. We all looked around and just like smiled, like, this is fucking hilarious. And then when they announced that we had won, it was a lightning bolt moment that I feel very fortunate to have experienced. It was, words can't describe the feeling of happiness for, not like, it wasn't in terms of like a retrospective of like, oh, all the work that we've put in, I remember when we were 16, or it was nothing like that. It was more of like, I'm happy for our team and all of the people that have busted their asses working with us and working on our behalf, and like, you know, pulled late nights and had crazy phone calls, and like these people who our management we're extremely close with, and when we started working with them, they kind of dropped their entire workload to work with us, and they were working with quite a few notable artists. So for those kinds of things and for their families to be rewarded that way, like that was the real feeling of happiness that I got, that we had something to show for like a tangible
totally
achievement, even if it's in a category that I don't necessarily care too much about. Like it was never part of my goals to win a Juno, but no. You know, for to have that official recognition from one of the more recognizable institutions in our country is obviously
absolutely.
It's an honor. It's an
absolutely.
Honor.
Absolutely. And like, now your mom goes to the yoga class and she can tell, you know, people, oh, you know, instead of saying like, oh, my son's in a band, and you're like, oh God, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
the
like,
role,
no, they won a Juno. Oh my God, they won a Juno?
Yeah.
You know, it's like the only thing better than that is if you get played on the radio. That parents love when they hear their kids'
bands
on
the radio.
Yeah,
exactly.
They're on the radio. Exactly. So.
Bada boom.
But a boom. Yeah, man. So I guess with this new record coming out, September 14th, Master Volume,
yes.
John Goodmanson, who is a very notable producer out of Seattle, and you mentioned some of the bands like Blood Brothers, Death Cab for Cutie, you know, but one band that he did that I thought was interesting is a band I'm a big fan of called Cloud Nothings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a similar kind of band to you guys, not in a lot of ways, but in the fact that they're a stripped down kind of band. They have a lot of crazy kind of guitar parts. Was that any reason that you worked with him, or was it just a bunch of factors?
We worked with John because he was the one who kind of, he mixed Higher Power, and by mixed Higher Power, I could maybe say that I got to touch one more time on Higher Power, but it was essentially a learning experience for all people involved, and there was a lot of like our friends who kind of participated in the making of it. But by the time we got it to mixing, John was the only person who gave us back a test mix, who kind of made something that we were like, fuck yeah, this actually sounds pretty good. So
right.
He mixed it and he fixed it. It was, we kind of gave him a bit of a mess, to be honest with you, and he made a record out of it. And I mean, we met with several different producers when we were getting all of this material together, And John, we had known as a trusted dude because of how easily the mixing of Higher Power had gone, but also just as a dude, we'd had lunch with him and hung out with him, and he had come out to the final gig of the Warped Tour out in Seattle.
Yeah.
So he came out to that show, and we had some cheese balls and talked to some Utz cheese balls. Shout out to Utz. But he came on the bandwagon, and we talked about his mixing the record, and that's kind of when we decided to go with him, like, for Higher Power. So he was in our Rolodex, and he also, you know, I'm sure you can agree too, like, when you're looking at producers, and you can only really gauge your decision off one or so conversations or lunches together, it's a gut feeling that you got to go with, right?
Yeah.
Of like who you're going to get along with the best and who you're going to be able to work with most effectively. And I mean, we met with some other really cool producers, but he was the one that was his goals seemed the most akin to ours and most compatible. And he's just such a great guy to work with, like such a great guy to hang with. He's just a very mellow, but very, very professional guy who we needed a veteran producer at this point in our career. We needed somebody to really, I mean, we had the arrangements more or less bought like pretty fastened down, but we needed somebody to actually shape the sound because we had no idea what the fuck we were doing in that category. We wanted somebody
hard,
to,
right? Because when you guys jam as a three piece, you only have, you know, one guitar. How do you make that guitar sound the way you want it to sound so that it sounds, you know, like it does when you guys are in a room? But also, I mean, you have to have it stereo. You have to have things doubled in places. You have to have all that stuff that is never easy to do as a three-piece band.
Exactly.
You know, when you do a lead, is there going to be a rhythm guitar or not? You know, like, what do you decide there? Those kinds of things.
And so, as I said, like, majority of the man hours that our band puts in are in sitting around and arranging the song of making sure that it kicks ass live and that it's not dependent on like okay, well, whatever, when we get to record it, we'll just do a rhythm track there and a lead over it, and like we'll figure out how we're going to do it live. That's not how we organize our music. We're very much so focused on how things will translate live and working within the three-piece parameter. That's what I think is definitely a big part of my creativity, is how to make the most of those simple ingredients and how to get dynamics out of them and interesting compositions. And that's so we throw around a lot of ideas when it comes to I mean, I use some open tunings I try and stay away from doing things where there's going to be a lead that leaves the bass just to deal with it by it, or the rhythm kind of by itself, unless that's how it's designed, you know. So we don't do a whole lot of like rhythm tracks on top of leads and stuff, but John was a great guy to be like, okay, well, how about this though, to like just kind of flesh it out a little bit more. And so the focus on this record, rather like as opposed to Higher Power, was to kind of surrender ourselves somewhat to the process and to somebody else who has a lot more knowledge than we do about how to make a good record. I think when we made Higher Power, there was a lot more of a dogmatic, no, fuck you, we know what we want kind of attitude in our camp. And this time we were like, John, whatever you think, let's just go with it. And then like sometimes be like, okay, we don't want to do that, let's do this. And he was like, cool. And so it was very much so, there was very few moments where we had any kind of disagreements.
Oh, that's good. Wow, that's a good sign.
Yeah, it's a very collaborative relationship. And in no ways was he a pushover or anything. He would tell you exactly what he thought.
Yeah.
But we were, I mean, we had done the you know, 90% of the work, 95% of the work of the arrangements by just working every day for a year on the songs and having stupid fights and like finally reaching breakthroughs. And those, like, you know, the battle was won and lost in the jam space already. We were very much so ready to make the record. And John was there. It was awesome to have somebody who was, you know, very much so a fan
fan of the band and into what we're doing, but he hadn't been dragged through those 100 hours or whatever, or more, hundreds of hours of like, no, I want to do a G7, motherfucker. Like he was coming in with fresh ears and still an enthusiasm for the material. And we needed that kind of fresh take on it.
By that point,
you know, you're sick of some of the songs, even though you like them. By that point, you've heard him too many goddamn times, so it was great hearing them through fresh ears and just kind of a very laid back but enthusiastic producer. It was a perfect environment.
Absolutely. Well, there's been a bunch of songs from the record that have been released, and I want to talk about one in particular. It's called "I Don't Want That Phone Call," which is a very intense song, especially. I don't know if you heard about the singer for We Came as Romans who just died of a drug overdose at age 28. Literally just the other week, I attended his funeral, and the podcast owner of the network, Mike Mowry, who runs this podcast network, he used to manage the band and stuff. So it's been very heavy around here with that. Talk to me about this song. I mean, literally, you say something about drugs and alcohol at 28, you know, is this about you? Is this about someone you know? What is this about?
This is about, I would say, somebody, if I'm being particular, this is about somebody that I know, who I grew up with, who is one of my best friends, who is probably, I would consider, like, one of my best friends along with Kyle, but like a different kind of friend who was a lot smarter than anybody else I knew, who was extremely ambitious, extremely motivated and inquisitive and curious, was constantly like blowing my mind with pieces of information, and was just extremely, I could rail on forever about how influential this person was on my life. When we got to our late teens, early 20s, and you're fucking around a lot, just like, you know, drinking and enjoying freedom from your parents, he began to go down a path that I could immediately see was trouble. And I haven't seen him in years, and I've just kind of heard tidbits of what's going on, and it's been a bit disturbing and sad, because, you know, it's hard, it's difficult accepting that like relationships change and people kind of come in, and especially out of your life, even if you want them to stay in your life, things change. And that subject has been definitely, and him in particular has been quite a very kind of a dark but compelling inspiration or muse for some of the things that I've written about. In particular, I think I feel a little bit a potential guilt shining some light on somebody who's got some problems, but I don't feel that that's what I'm actually doing. I'm trying to intellectualize and just deal with and process my anger and frustration with the fact that my friend's destroying themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not in any way pointing out their identity or trying to make them embarrass them in any way. Of course, that would be the last thing I want to do, but I'm sure you can kind of empathize. It's hard to choose about what you're going to write about. You just kind of do, you know, just kind of like, you kind of got to go with whatever's making you feel a certain way. And I mean, that song happened really, really fast, right at the end of everything. I had the riff, that kind of like riff kind of bouncing around. Mm-hmm. And the last few songs of A Crop are always my favorite songs. Like when you're kind of, when things are rolling, you know, it's always the hardest getting the first few together. Once you get the first few together and you got some like, okay, we got this one in the bank and this one in the bank, the pressure starts kind of like easing off, and then you get the momentum and you're all working together great. The last few are usually some of the finest. So
That was one of my favorite ones for sure of the record.
Totally.
At the very end. And but I mean, those are the personal, my personal connection to those, to the song itself. But my general kind of hope for it is that people can extrapolate and apply some of the things to their own lives in a cautionary sense.
Yeah,
like, I think that
absolutely, man.
One of my kind of touchstones and mantras of this entire album cycle is I just turned 28, and my if I have any kind of platform to speak to kids that are younger than me, I would just say that, like, be careful with the things in life that can kill you. And like, I'm not saying to not have fun and enjoy yourself. And, but if you are at all, if I'm at all in a position to offer you any advice and you want to hear it, I would just say, just be careful with your body and your brain, because, you know, at this point I've obviously, you know, being a touring musician for all of my 20s at this point, I have seen the casualties of things that appeared very kind of glossy and attractive when you're about 19 or 20. Like, excess doesn't start to really rear its ugly face yet, but
yeah,
towards your late 20s, you can kind of see the ramifications of certain behaviors and habits. And I'm very much so interested in trying to affect younger people in a positive way if I have an ability to do so.
Absolutely, and yes, and this is a fucking epidemic. It's really not great. But I do ask you that. I mean, this is your second album, you know, your second full-length album, and it's the first time you've written knowing that a lot of people are going to hear this.
Yes.
Does it change, like, you know, you're talking about younger people and sort of, I don't want to say being a role model, but you're conscious of the fact that people are listening. Does that change the way that you write at all?
I don't think so. I think that it's funny. I think that this album came together in the perfect kind of environment, which is isolated somewhat from the rest of the world in the jam space with the boys, you know, rather than like we're still slugging it out in the clubs when we're making it and you know, getting together like a band and putting the time in. So there wasn't, even though that was in the back of my mind, that because as we were making these songs, the career, our profile started to rise more and more and more.
Yeah.
But it was still very much so that same kind of like jamming in the dirty basement, like kind of arguing about or discussing, I should say, what the next chord change is or whether this part should be quiet or loud. Or so it was kind of born in the same circumstances as before, and that the bone, like that kind of thing, that a lot more people are probably going to hear this record than heard the last record.
Right.
That feeling was more of just like a motivator in my mind to make sure that the arrangements were tighter. But I can't help but, as I said, like when being at this age in my late 20s and having toured and seeing the way that kids have responded to our band, especially that last tour with Against Me, like seeing these kids in Texas who I never thought would ever have heard of our band, these kids who, please play this song, I need this song, it drove 3 hours, like that can't, like that's something that having that kind of impact on somebody's life who lives so far away, it was just a motivating factor, I think, to just do a really good job on making our next album.
Love it.
And but I think that the whole thing about like I kind of viewed like Higher Power as like an album talking more about in a lot of like about and in kind of going and exploring America. It's a lot of it's kind of that. But this one is more of a record born out of experience and experiencing things and seeing some shit happen and reflecting on that. So, I mean, As I said, like, I don't want to be someone standing there wagging their finger at people trying to tell them what to do, but I would come and gently implore the youth of the world to be careful with your old brain there, because you only get one brain.
Yes. Some people have half a brain though.
So if you have half a brain, you get one, be more careful.
There you go.
Exactly.
All right, man. Dude, well, thank you so much. I don't really have anything else to ask you. You covered it all, I think. There's a tour coming up. You're doing a headliner. Let the people know about that.
So we're going to Europe in late September, England and Germany.
Beautiful.
I don't have the dates in front of me right now, but then in the mid-October till December 1st, we are touring the United States and Canada. All dates available on Instagram or Facebook. Okay. As well as we've got a new website, thedirtynail.com, and we're bringing out our friends from Vancouver called Dead Soft, who are a fantastic band. I really, really love their band. We played with them a couple years ago. They are, I would say, very much so cut from the same cloth as us musically, of a heavy kind of power pop vibe, but big crushing poppy choruses.
Awesome.
They're an excellent band. I'm very excited to bring them out. And this is our first headlining tour in about 2 years, really, like our first big one. So I couldn't be more excited to get on the road and do a big, big show for the children of the world.
There you go.
What I'm saying?
I love it, man. Dude, thank you. Thanks for doing this. When this airs, the record will be out. So it is out now.
Beautiful.
The record is out now, people. Go pick it up.
Excellent.
Go listen to
Master
it.
Master volume.
Now, I always play music at the end of the show. What song from this record would you like the people to hear? I'll let you pick one.
That's a good question. I would say let's go with I Don't Want That Phone Call. Let's do that.
All right. It's an important song, and I'll send it out to Kyle Pavone. Rest in peace, brother. And thank you, Luke. All the best, man. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much, Shane. Always, always a pleasure.
The Dirty Nil, a great tune and an important message. And the Dirty Nil are here with a tremendous, tremendous second album. I didn't know if they could top the first, to be honest.
And I didn't want to bring up the whole sophomore slump thing, because this is not a sophomore slump. This record is a banger. So check it out. It is available now. You can buy vinyl. You can get it on all the streaming services. However you choose, it is out there. So check it out. I want to thank Luke and everybody in the Dirty Nil just for being great people, a great band, and for taking the time to speak with me. And thank you for listening to this thing. Next week, we'll be back again, as always, with another brand new episode. So yes, make sure you're subscribed. Hit that subscribe button. And if you like the show, check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. And you know what? Just tell a friend, tell a loved one, anybody you think that's interested in hearing two lead singers talk about what it's like and talk about music and get everything out there that you just don't get in a standard interview. And that's why I started this thing. Let them know to check out this podcast. All right, I know it's running long, but I don't care. We got to play one more song. Here's a classic Dirty Nil song to leave you with. An oldie but a goodie. Here is Fucking Up Young on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love, and we'll see you next time.